welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous guest all the way from LA, where I hear it's very, very hot. Unlike here, where it's freezing. Among them's name is film. Kevin Janesberry, the director's here. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start the story. Go ahead. Are you like a Supernatural fan? Is that where this comes from, this idea?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan of all types of movies, but doing something a little bit supernatural was like a cool change of pace. I've always liked the tone and the style of supernatural things because you can do so many different things visually with them.
So you really rely, I mean, not all filmmakers do, but sounds of your film. You constantly are cutting to sounds. I'm hearing sounds added in. I'm hearing sounds in the film. Maybe the actors are even adding in sounds as you go. So was that your plan for the whole film?
Yeah, the audio was always planned to be like a really important part of the movie because so much of the emotion comes from audio, just like hearing a weird creak or something startling, just being loud. It really helps, I think, especially when you're working with like a low budget film where your production value is limited. You can always go the extra yard with your audio, with your sound design. So it's kind of like an inexpensive way to kind of bump up your production values.
So also you have a moving car shooting. How is that different the way you normally shoot?
A moving car shoot?
Yeah.
They were kind of like a crazy way to do it. Part of what we did was we had a car with a sunroof, and I would just pop out of the top of the sunroof with a camera on my shoulder and try to get like an interesting angle on the car. So that was definitely like, it was challenging because you don't really realize how much you're going to shake around when you're hanging out of a car. So we had to do some stabilization in post to fix it up a little bit.
So how do you, okay, you're in post, you got your footage, you're like, look at this, it's shaky. How do you stabilize that?
With really nice software that basically does all the work for you. You just kind of like hit your buttons and then it processes it and it kind of spits out something that looks a little bit better.
Did it upset you at the time you saw this, or were you like, no, I know how to fix that, no problem?
I figured I'd have to work with it, and it was really just the best that I could do at the time, so I figure either we reshoot it or I'm able to fix it in post, so I wasn't too stressed about it, but it's a little like physically challenging to shoot that way for sure.
I think we have to go back on, you're an indie production. Reshoots cannot be something you ever want to return to, I would think, just because you're on a set budget, set time. And, like, how does that work when you have to do a reshoot, or do you do reshoots?
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to remember if we did a reshoot on this. I know we were planning a big one, and then we ended up not doing it because we found some solutions in editing that kind of, like, worked away the problems way that we had. But, yeah, it's always difficult to try to do a reshoot because a lot of people have tight schedules and they've got to move on after a production's over. And also, you know, even if they have the schedule open, maybe they change their hair or their beard or something like that. And people are just also in a different mental, like, headspace. Like, they got to recall that character after they've kind of let it go and they thought they were done with it.
So since you just brought up the word character, let's discuss probably the most interesting character, the man that works at the hotel reception.
Ah, yes, the clerk.
I think he describes every clerk I've ever met.
Really?
I think they're all very strange, a lot of them, especially those small hotels. Not a big hotel. They seem to have a certain demeanor, but those small niche hotels.
Right, yeah. I imagine it's a very solitary job, so it kind of makes sense that it might give people some interesting character tics.
So did you give him some direction to be like, I want you to be creepy, I want you to be inquisitive, I want you to drive the lead character nuts?
Yeah, definitely. Michael Reed's a really great actor, so he interprets things really well, and I think very instinctually, without needing to be given a lot of direction. And also, I think a lot of the character came from just the wardrobe decisions that we made. When we were going around picking up wardrobe, we found these really awesome glasses that just looked like they belonged to a serial killer. And they were real glasses. They were like prescriptions, so when he wore them, his vision was actually messed up. Every time we were filming, but he was able to do it because he's such a trooper. But I think just the putting on that character and putting on those clothes kind of helped him figure out just how to play them.
So let's back this up. Your wardrobe choices. Now, when you're starting to cast a film, you haven't even got there. So do you have your wardrobe first or do you do your cast first?
In this film, we had the cast first. That was one of the first things that we did, actually. Right after writing the script, we had some people in mind that we wanted to shoot with, and we just called them up and asked if they were available and interested. So that was the first step. And when we had our cast, that's when we moved into more of the regular pre-production phase of, like, getting the wardrobe and the location secured and all that stuff.
So I want to go back to the wardrobe. How do you know what your characters? I mean, you're designing this. You have to do set locations. How do you know that wardrobe's going to work? I mean, you have to take measurements or you just go, okay, I think they're in XL.
Yeah, we were lucky to have worked with our actors prior to this, most of them. So the ones that we were picking out wardrobe for, I think we had a pretty good idea of their size. And they also sent in some measurements to make sure that we were going to get things that fit. It was really just a process of like going to weird little like thrift stores and just trying to find old kind of interesting looking clothes. And we also went to Target too and just got kind of very generic dark clothing for the bank robbers. Yeah, we just we tried to keep the expenses down by going to cheap stores like that, and we were lucky to find some really good pieces.
So I want to get to my first. I hope I'm not going to ruin anything. We do have a discovery in a vehicle. I think that's the general. I'm not really ruining anything.
Yeah, it's in the trailer.
I didn't know. I didn't see the trailer. How long was that person stuck in the car, and how cold was it?
It was cold, I would imagine. She didn't seem very happy when they opened the trunk, did she? Timeline-wise, this is kind of like one of the more mysterious aspects of the story. Like, how did she wind up there? And it's not really spelled out exactly, but my idea is that she was kidnapped, abducted, probably for some sort of ransom money by this criminal organization. And they put her in the car, forgot about her, and then they gave that car to other people in their organization saying, like, here's your getaway car, not realizing that they left somebody in there.
So who got to the lucky thing of tying her up?
Who got the job of tying her up?
Correct.
Did you say?
Yes.
I think that was mostly Evelina herself, actually, somehow. I think we might have all helped out a little bit when her hands were finally bound. But I don't really know any good knots, so I think that was mostly her.
So when you take an actor and throw them in the shower, do you heat it up beforehand or you just toss them in cold?
We probably should have in retrospect. But no, Evelina's a really, really, she's not super delicate when it comes to acting. She's very tough and she can kind of take anything you throw at her. So we just basically put her down in the shower and Dan hit the shower and just sprayed her with water. And I'm not sure what the temperature was, but her direction was to start screaming and that's what she did.
She did a very good job. So
yeah.
Did you ever think of filming your film in the summer? Cause I mean, it looks cold where you are.
No, we didn't think of doing it in the summer because we were familiar with the area and we had just visited recently the town of Hampton Beach in New Hampshire. And the way that it looked was like creepy and magical at the same time, just going to the beach and seeing all the sand covered with like a layer of snow. Yeah. And seeing how the whole town was just shut down is a total ghost town because it's a beach resort town in New England. And in the winter, there's nobody there because everybody there just rents. So there's just a few people left over who actually live there year-round. So we felt like this was such a cool location. It had the vibe. It had, like, the atmosphere that we were going for this film. So shooting there in the winter was very important to the story.
So I guess that will involve my next question. You have a shootout at one point during your film.
Yeah.
I guess that was easy because there was nobody there to even hear it. Do you have to get a permit for that or you just said, they said, go right ahead and do what you want?
It was remarkably easy, luckily, because there was so few people there. We did approach the police about it and we said, this is what we want to do. What would be, you know, the necessary steps to make sure it's safe for everybody involved? And they were like, there's nobody here. Don't worry about it. And we were like, so we don't need, like, a police detail or anything? They're like, no, as long as you're out of sight of the public, you'll be fine. So we're like, okay, we'll go do it then.
So nobody came by to notice, or did anybody even notice what you were doing?
No, I don't think anybody even really noticed what we were doing.
Oh, that's kind of funny.
So we told the police in advance. We said, we're going to be here. We're going to be doing this scene. It's going to be guns outside and everything. They're like, that's cool.
That's awesome.
They were really great. Yeah, it was awesome. We got really lucky.
We do have to discuss your hotel a bit more, I think. Mm-hmm. Did you have any problems getting that? Or they said, yeah, go ahead, because there's nobody here, so you can rent what you want?
Yeah, it was a pretty similar situation, because there was just not that many people in the rooms, and I think they were just happy to have somebody renting out the rooms for, you know, a week at a time. So they gave us a really good deal, and they kind of gave us the run of the place and let us film there. They even let us shoot the intro into the basement scene by utilizing their own basement.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So how did you find a payphone, something that doesn't really exist anymore?
That took some hunting. This was actually shot many years ago, and we just basically finally got out of post-production on it and got the distribution lined up. And I think maybe back then it was a little bit easier to find a payphone, but even then, yeah, it took some hunting.
So I'm going to have to back you up for a second here. When was this filmed?
This was filmed in 2011. So... Let me do my math.
That's 9 years.
A while ago.
Well, okay, now we're going to... I guess we're going to have to ask you the big question. Why does it take so long to go from 2011 to 9 years to make a film?
Yeah, that's... It's totally, like, something I've been thinking about myself, actually. I'm like, why does this take so long? Part of it was we shot it... I was living on the East Coast at the time, and after shooting it, moved to Los Angeles. And since moving to Los Angeles, I basically had to restart and figure out how to make a living, started working in the film industry, and was doing that full-time, just trying to survive. And afterwards, I had also to finish my first film. So I was stuck in post-production on two films at once and had to deal with the distribution of the first film first. And then I got to finally work on Among Them in post-production. And a big thing was that since we didn't have any money, I had to do a lot of it myself. The editing, like a lot of the sound design, the ADR sessions, I had to wait for all the actors to be able to, you know, send in their ADR or come out to sessions in LA to do them. And then I had to find a really great composer that I could get that was basically just excited about the film. So all these different searches for different people and aspects and elements that you need to put into the film and post-production just took a long time.
So, okay, you've done the film in 2011. It's coming out now. Do the actors bug you in the last 9 years about the film, or have they just forgotten about it?
They've been either really patient or forgetful. I'm not sure. Because they haven't been bugging me about it. And they've been just really supportive and really patient. So I'm really fortunate to have a bunch of people behind this that understand that it can take a long time.
So you took away my next question, your music. You do use music throughout your film. So let's discuss a little bit more. Let's give the conductor or the organizer or whatever, let's give him some shout-outs. Tell me where you found him, what's he about, and why'd you pick him?
Liam Fox O'Brien is the composer for this film. I found him online. It was a pretty long search of just putting up classified ads and listening to a lot of different composers. And there were a lot of really great ones, a lot of good people to choose from. I think I found that they kind of all had, many of them had a very similar style. And it sounded like other scores, it sounded like other films I had heard before. And for this film, I knew it was offbeat. It's a little bit different. In tone and style and the way the story is told. And I felt like it really needed a very unique sound. And Liam had that. He had that very unique sound that I was looking for, and I knew he was going to be the right person for it.
So I guess what I want to get on to next is you're in a very small room for most of this shot. I mean, I like you do take it outside. I do appreciate the breath of fresh air. But do you find that you wanted the film to feel claustrophobic? Even near the end, I felt the film felt even tighter. Was that your goal, to have a, like a descending? Because we're outside most times in the beginning, and as the film goes along, I find you get tighter and tighter and tighter.
Yeah, claustrophobia is definitely an emotion, like a button we wanted to push throughout the film. And I think you got it right. Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to become more and more claustrophobic as the film progresses, and we also tried to make it more and more tense and darker, essentially, too. As we shot it, every scene was supposed to become more and more kind of contrasty and darker so that you feel this descent into a darker world.
Fair enough. I also want to discuss, I know I'm going on about tying up. Who got to tie her up in the closet? Because that looked painful.
Yeah, that was probably me. I think taping her. She was holding herself up with her own strength for the most part. And the tape that was around her hands was just kind of for show to, you know, explain why she was hanging like that.
Now, I want to know where you got your masks and why did you choose those masks?
Where did we get the masks?
I'm making this remember 9 years ago. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It was just like a regular Halloween store kind of mask. It's a very generic kind of make. And I think it's sort of designed so that you can paint your own design onto it. And we felt like it was a really like uncanny look to it where you can see some of a person's face through it, but it's distorted in just the right way where it just gives a really creepy effect of like, is that human or what's under there?
I thought you were going with like a serial killer mask idea because it totally looked like an 80s serial killer mask I would expect to see in some 80s slasher film.
Yeah, it might have struck me that way on a kind of a subconscious level. I can see that.
So you're a very small production, and you're in a small town, you've told me. How do you cater? Do you have to go out and get food? Is anything even open in this town?
We had restaurants that were open, yeah. So we would shoot for a while and go get food, and Anya, one of our caterer essentially for the film, was one of our producer's girlfriends at the time, so she was basically cooking also a lot for us as well. We're very fortunate to have her there to have like home cooked meals too, on top of the groceries that we would go get.
One thing I did forget about the film: who invites a hooker over when you have a buddy in the room?
I think the type of criminal that really just doesn't have the same social standards that everybody else does. I think it is telling of his character that he's like, that's where his priorities were at that time.
I think so. The hooker has a very interesting dance, I want to say right now. I think that's a very good comment to say. That I don't know.
Yes, Sarah Nicklin, I think, brought a lot a lot to that role for sure. It's a smaller role, but she really made it interesting, especially with the dance for sure.
I don't. Again, let's. I don't think there can be any small roles in independent film. I really think everybody has to have something to do because you have a small budget. You got to get your point out, and you got to go fast. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. This film it doesn't have a very large cast. It's pretty small, and I think that let us really develop the characters and spend a lot of time with them and get to know them and see their journey and see how they progress through the whole thing.
Yeah, I definitely like your lead actor, the lead main guy. I think looks very big compared to the other guy. The other guy looks like he's new. And again, you got the last job kind of thing going off.
Yeah. Yeah, Jonathan Thompson and Dan Lehman were the two leads in it. And we had worked with them before. Jonathan Thompson was the lead in my first film, Serena and the Rats. And I just adore working with him. He's super talented, and he's got a great, like, old Hollywood look. Dan is also a really great actor. He's got a different style, like a different process, and he's got I don't know how to, like, explain it exactly, but he does have that, like, kind of rebel without a cause vibe about him.
Well, I like that about your casting. I found everybody felt real. This could have been a real scenario. I mean, nobody really, like, they all work, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Nobody stood out saying, oh, that's not really right for me.
But, oh, thank you.
But good job on the directing there. I did like the feel. So, again, I want to go back to shooting in the small room before we move on to something else. How is setting up your camera? Like, it is tight in that place at times, it looks like. Did you have enough room?
Yeah.
Are you, like, up on a bed? Are you, like, out the door?
Yeah, we put the camera in any crazy configuration that we could to get the shot. There was one moment where we were, like, basically putting a small jib on top of the bed because there was nowhere else to put the bed. We were trying to get this moving shot. And as we were, like, kind of assembling, I was looking at it, I was like, okay, time out. This is not safe. We have to take this down right now. There's no way we're shooting like this and, like, risking hurting somebody. But, yeah, we were able to actually get a small jib into the room and get a couple shots with it. It was so small that we had to, like, rotoscope out pieces of equipment and stuff like that in post because they would get into the frame somehow. But overall, I felt like it was kind of just the right size to shoot a small room, but with enough to, like, do something with it.
Fair enough. Did you think of any different endings at the time, or you just always wanted that descent ending?
Yeah, we did. We had thought of a couple different endings. Evelina Marie was the writer on it, and she wrote it very fast. It only took her a couple days to write the script, like basically without sleeping.
Oh,
and
no thanks.
We had shot the ending, and we were just a little bit worried about like audience comprehension after editing it together. And we're like, maybe we should add a voiceover that kind of like spells this out a little bit more. Maybe we should shoot some more stuff. And I think we were able to just go with what we had by using editing to tell this story. And I hope that it comes across in a way that people understand emotionally, that they get something out of it emotionally.
Well, I think they definitely can. It's there. You gotta relax. It's gotta think. And don't get too claustrophobic like I did.
Right. Yeah, like take a pause and take a breath once in a while if you get a little freaked out by it.
So, since we're near the end of the questions, it's time for my favorite part, three fun questions.
Okay.
Because your first time on the show, and if you come back, you won't have the same questions again, so you can't prepare. Your favorite film?
Something that I've seen recently that I like a lot is Too Old to Die Young by Nicholas Winding Refn. It's a series. It's not a film.
Oh, that's why I don't know.
But I think... Yeah, narratively, it's just, like, such an amazing show. I think stylistically, it's very maybe ahead of its time or maybe calling up the past of, like, classic cinema and the pacing. Trying to think of another one.
I like your option, film. Though. He does.
I think one that might be relevant to this one is John Carpenter's The Thing. Just that sense of claustrophobia in a cold environment in a source of evil, of destruction that you're not familiar with. But I think that was probably a big inspiration on this film, too.
One book that inspired you to be a filmmaker?
Rebel Without a Crew by Robert Rodriguez. I think I had already started on the filmmaking journey at that point. But it was super inspiring to read a story of a filmmaker who started with nothing, essentially, and became one of the most successful film directors of all time, or, you know, of our recent history.
And your last question, one film you recommend to people because they've never seen it? Ooh, I've heard of it.
I can't remember the country that it was filmed in. It's a foreign language film. About another heist film gone bad where people that are stealing a bunch of gold are held up in somebody's, I want to say, like, not house, but kind of a plaza. And the police close in and a lot of violence ensues. Let's see, what else we got? Kill List. I can't give you guys a lot of, like, background on these films because they're just sort of things that I've seen a long time ago.
It's all good.
Kill List is definitely, like, a really interesting one about hitmen who also encounter a force of evil that they can't quite grasp. Holy Motors is a really good one.
That's a few years old now.
I'm not even going to try to describe that. That's out of my league of trying to describe. Maybe Melancholia is a good one for people to check out if they haven't seen that yet.
Lars von Trier, 2 hours. Christian Banks. I've seen that one.
Really beautiful movie. Very depressing, but very beautiful.
Before we let you go, you got to tell everybody where they can find your film.
Absolutely. It's on Amazon Prime, streaming there, and it's also available for rent on Amazon. And it's streaming on TubiTV.com, which is a free service, so you can watch it without paying for anything. You don't even have to sign up. It just has commercial breaks, so you can choose which flavor you like.
Thank you for your time, and have a great evening.
Thank you.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.